Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Today on ID the Future, guest host Beatrice Russo goes on the road, this time to interview Bob Marks, the director of the Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence and distinguished professor of electrical and computer engineering at Baylor University.
I am here with Dr. Robert J. Marks at the summer seminar. And Dr. Marks, you had a lecture on artificial intelligence, which is definitely a hot subject today. And I wanted to ask you, what was your lecture about? And if you can give us a summary, that would be great.
Okay. Well, one of the things I wanted to do is to talk about some of the great advancements in artificial intelligence. It's really an exciting area. And we've seen all sorts of things happening in artificial intelligence. One of the things that we tried to do was define artificial intelligence. I think a lot of people talk about AI, but nobody defines it. We defined it as something that was gee whiz that you could do with a computer. And we're surrounded by artificial intelligence. And it's really exciting, from Uber to Amazon.com to Alexa, all of these different applications of AI. In fact, they're so ubiquitous that we kind of take them for granted. We're numbed by familiarity. And so that's one of the things that we wanted to stress. The other one is what the future of AI is and what AI can do and what AI can't do. Specifically, are there things that humans can do that artificial intelligence will never be able to do? The answer indeed is yes. There are some things that artificial intelligence can't do, that humans are able to do. And these are things which you can't write code for. You can't write code for creativity. You can't write a computer program that says, be creative. You can't write a computer program to say, experience qualia. You can't write a computer program to be conscious. All of these are specific human traits that are not codable and therefore are not achievable. So I think in looking at all of the hype that we see in the media today about artificial intelligence, that recognizing the ceiling of what artificial intelligence can obtain is very, very important to understand what it can and can't do. So that was kind of the overview.
So my question is, can machines take over? And if they can to some measure, what does that mean to our society?
A lot of things need to be defined there. What do you mean by take over? If you mean take over in the sense of the Terminator franchise, where Skynet became self-aware or conscious or whatever, nobody ever defines what self-aware or consciousness is. In fact, I didn't and said it couldn't be done. But no, if you talk about the singularity, the idea of artificial intelligence writing better artificial intelligence, that writes better artificial intelligence that eventually has superhuman capabilities that's going to dominate us, no, that isn't going to happen. In order for artificial intelligence to write better artificial intelligence, it would have to be creative. And as I mentioned before, AI cannot be creative. You're going to get surprising results. You're going to get like the great move that happened in AlphaGo that nobody expected, and everybody says that was creativity. No, come on. The program was trained to play Go, and that's what it was doing. If it asked for a drink or a cola or played chess or something like that without additional programming, then I would say it displayed human capabilities. But no, there was no creativity there. So in order for things to get smarter and smarter and smarter like it did in Skynet, it does require the computer code be creative. And there has been no computer code which is shown to be creative. We have to, again, define creative. We haven't defined it yet, but creative in the sense that I define it. Would you like me to define it?
Yes.
Okay. Creativity is defined by Selmer Bringsjord's definition of the Lovelace test. A computer program will be creative if that computer program responds with an output that can't be explained by the computer programmer. If that indeed happens, then the computer program is creative. This does not mean that we can't have surprising results, such as the move in Go, and some really interesting results. We did a lot of work in swarm intelligence, where we actually did evolution on a number of individual agents, and we got all sorts of very interesting results here that we didn't expect. We found, for example, self-sacrifice, that the swarm would self-sacrifice itself in order to prolong its life. We were trying to maximize the life of the swarm. And that wasn't expected, but hey, we programmed the system to last as long as we could. By the way, that work was done by Dr. Winston Ewart. So, in fact, it's on the, if you're interested in looking on it, it's on the website neoswarm.com. And you can go and actually look at the videos, the unexpected videos. But again, even though the results were surprising, we had evolved this thing to last as long as we can. And this was a good, viable result. So that was not creative because the computer program was doing exactly what we told it to do. If it went on and did some additional things, if it learned to attack, we didn't program it to attack, but if it attacked the predators in order to survive, then it would have been creative. But no, it didn't. Why? Because we didn't program it to do that. That's the way that computer programming works.
I want to take us a step back here and wanted to ask you to go ahead and define artificial intelligence.
Well, you know, that's a great question. Because everybody uses artificial intelligence like they do consciousness and qualia and all these other things without really defining them. My definition of artificial intelligence is anything computers do, which you stand back and you say, gee whiz, that's incredible. And today's artificial intelligence is not yesterday's artificial intelligence. I don't know if people think of Amazon.com when you go there and you order and it does all of these electronic number crunching and then spits you your result and ships your package to your home. I don't know if they talk about that as artificial intelligence. I don't know if Google Maps is considered artificial intelligence, but my goodness, you program where you're going and where you're at, and it gives you the best route. That's really incredible. That is artificial intelligence. But as I mentioned, we are kind of numbed by familiarity. And because of that numbness, we look towards the latest dopamine hit as to what else is coming out and what else is exciting. So again, artificial intelligence is probably any gee whiz application of computers. Now, I think that there are people in the trench. By the trench, I mean people in academia that would argue with me. They use terms like artificial intelligence, computational intelligence, machine intelligence, and they use them in specific ways. But I think in the media and the general communication of the idea of artificial intelligence, I like my definition because I think that that's what the media means.
We also hear these terms, deep learning, machine learning, and artificial intelligence. Could you, according to your definition, what the differences are there?
Certainly, deep learning is an instantiation of artificial intelligence, and it's very popular. Deep reinforcement learning was used to train AlphaGo to beat the world champion of the world's hardest board game, which is Go, and it did so very, very effectively. Deep convolutional neural networks are being used for a number of different applications. One of the exciting applications one of my colleagues did was actually look at white eye syndrome in children, and this is a precursor for eye cancer. And he actually did deep learning on a number of different cases, and you can get this app for free and put it on your phone, and it actually scans all your pictures of your kids and tells you whether you might have some problems with this precursor to eyeball cancer. That's a great application. But we're seeing some different limitations of the deep learning. Convolutional neural networks can be easily fooled, and that's a problem. There was a case where they recognized wolves versus, I believe, dogs, and they found out that really the neural network was learning about the snow in the background, which appeared in all of the pictures of the wolves. And so that wasn't good. There's also an example given by Gary Smith in his book, The AI Delusion, about recognition of tanks using artificial intelligence. And these tanks were recognized very well by neural networks. But then they discovered that all the pictures of tanks were taken in the evening and all the ones without tanks were taken in the morning. And that was actually just looking at the background information. So one always has to be careful with the black box sort of artificial intelligence where it gives you an output, but it gives you no explanation facility. It doesn't tell you why it reached that decision. You always have to look at the decision and decide for yourself. So there always needs to be a human in the loop and the differentiation of that. But there's a lot of interest now in deep reinforcement learning and deep convolutional neural networks, and we are beginning to learn some of the limitations. Everybody thought initially it was a panacea that could be applied to everything, but no, it has a problem with deconvolutional neural networks of overfitting, and you get some of the problems with the tanks and the wolves that I mentioned, and that's not good. So we'll see what happens. I think we're still in a situation of separating the chaff from the wheat.
Yeah, especially in computer vision today, there are a lot of advances that it comes to artificial intelligence and machine learning, especially. And I've heard of a case where they've trained the model to recognize cats. And so it gave enough input data to recognize different types of cats. And then with time to recognize more types of cats. And so it sounds to me that it is possible for the models to learn and to recognize new types or something that's similar enough to where even if it's different, it can recognize that type. If there's a certain amount of delta that's maybe not too great, but to be able to recognize something that's similar within that delta.
So yeah, what you're referring to is, I think, something which is missed a lot in the training of these artificial neural networks is that the problem that you're looking at has to be ergodic. It can't change. When deep reinforcement learning was used in AlphaGo, they played the game of Go, and they played it again and again and again and again and again. Now, the situation and the location of the markers on the board changed all the time, but it was always AlphaGo. Same thing with Deep Blue. It was a Deep Blue that beat Kasparov. They played chess again and again and again and again and again. Deep reinforcement learning has been used to beat Atari games just by looking at the pixel. An amazing, incredible result. But the problem was ergodic. It was the same process again and again and again and again and again. So that ergodicity is a very important aspect of the problem that can be trained by neural networks. And there's a great book called An Army of None. And it has basically dissed deep convolutional neural networks as an application because you don't have ergodicity, for example, on the battlefield. You have situations which are changing, which are fluid. And if you use these things, you better make sure that the scenario that you're looking at has been learned by your neural network. And if you are the enemy, you will try to come up with scenarios which disturb that ergodicity and then prove your neural network useless. So, yeah, there's a big problem there. Another classic example of non-ergodic system is the stock market. You cannot train a neural network to forecast the stock market. No matter what anybody else says. If somebody asks you, or somebody approaches you and says, you know, I used a neural network to train the stock market, the first thing you should respond is, what kind of car do you drive? Because the only true metric of a success of such a neural network is to see how it works in the marketplace. And if they truly did train artificial intelligence to forecast the market, they would be very wealthy. And most of the proponents of AI in finance are not rich and do not drive Lamborghinis. So
I wanted to ask you about, given the advancement of quantum computing, how do you think quantum computing will advance artificial intelligence?
Well, this goes back to a very fundamental idea of computer science, which is called the Church-Turing thesis. And the idea of the Church-Turing thesis is that computers today can do no more than Turing's original 1930s type paper did in terms of computation. We can only do it today faster, and a lot faster, billions and trillions of times faster. But if time were no problem, we could go back and work it on the Turing machine, and maybe it would take 1,000 years or something like that. Quantum computing is still going to obey the Church-Turing thesis. We're going to be able to do things a heck of a lot faster, but we are still constrained to algorithmic sort of operations. So therefore, things which AI can't do now, which is consciousness and creativity and stuff, can't be done by a quantum computer, except the quantum computer can't do it faster. I don't know what that means, but so it is not going to improve, and it's not going to give us this leap into all of this magic artificial intelligence.
So I hear a lot of concerns. People say that because of automation and now moreover artificial intelligence, that we will lose jobs and it will affect our economy. And so what are your ideas about and comments about that?
I guess in an overarching sense, the future of the economy has something to do with AI and creativity. People who have a dystopian view of the future are typically not appreciative of the incredible creative entrepreneurial capabilities of humans. And we said that AI couldn't be creative, but humans can. And that in turn goes into the market. And you're going to see entrepreneurial advancements, and these entrepreneurial advancements are going to need employment. And I'm relatively confident that we are not going to see this dystopian future where everybody needs some general universal basic income. They're not going to need that, because I think that first of all, the struggle is good. And that's easy for me to say. You know, if you drive a truck and you are removed as a truck driver, you got a problem in life. But I think in the macroeconomic sense, it's going to be very, very positive. And you have the dystopian side of people like Yuval Harari and some of his work. But then you have the very positive side. And I would refer listeners to works by George Gilder, The End of Google, Jay Richards in his latest book. And it was John Toomey, a book called, I believe, The End of Work, where he talks about the AI, if done the way that he envisions it, is going to allow us to have a lot more fun in life, because a lot of this mundane stuff is going to be taken away. Just like automation took away the problem of clothes washing, where you had to go down to the river and beat the clothes and spend eight hours a week beating the clothes and stuff. You don't have to do that anymore. Just throw them in the washer. And AI is going to come along and hopefully take a lot of those mundane sort of things and leave us more free time to enjoy life.
And some people that I talk to say, oh, well, I actually do enjoy to do some of the mundane. For example, some people really love driving and they just want to do that potentially as a part-time job, or especially when they're between jobs. So that's one example. And there's other examples like specific jobs in the factory. People do actually genuinely enjoy those mundane tasks. So how would you respond to those people?
I think no matter what, there's always going to be mundane jobs which which are left and can only be done by human beings. But if those jobs disappear, my gosh, those people are going to have to suffer and not work in the factory or not drive their cars, and they're going to have to spend their lives having more fun in different venues. So I don't know what to say to that. You know, I think that good people enjoy work. I think Solomon in the book of Ecclesiastes said the only good feeling that he had under the sun was the feeling he had after a good day's work, hard physical work. He didn't say hard physical work, but there is something about doing hard physical work for a day and just feeling the exhilaration of doing it. My mother used to mop the floor, and she would stand in the doorway and look at the floor and go, I did that. Look at that. That is so wonderful. So yeah, there's still going to be things of that sort. I think that the venue might be changing though, which AI might change the venue, and it might not. There's something, the name escapes me right now, the Marsburg effect or project, but it's that the simplest thing for people to do are very difficult for AI to do. Amazon, according to Jay Richards, has a big assembly line where they put things in the conveyor belt and they come along, but it still takes humans to place them in the box. So there's still these mundane operations which are still difficult for robotics and AI to do. So yeah, there's always going to be things to do, sure. People still might like to make their own beds, and even though AI can make your bed, I have a lot of friends that like to shoot. They like to reload their brass, you know, that's fine. That's recreational. And so that'll always be there. But you know what? You'll be able to do it for fun instead of to make money. And many times people do these mundane things to make money and they don't enjoy it. And according to people like Toomey and Jay Richards and some of these and some other people, George Gilder, for example, that the future of that is going to be something where you have a lot more fun doing a lot more fun things, and AI will allow us to do that, just like technology of the past has allowed us to do that.
Thank you so much, Dr. Marks, for your time. Okay. And for the answers.
Thank you.
That was guest host Beatrice Russo speaking with Bob Marks, the director of the Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence. Find that center online at centerforintelligence.org, centerforintelligence.org. And find more of Dr. Marks at mindmatters.ai, mindmatters.ai. This is ID the Future. Thank you for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.